If you listen to Solving JFK a lot, you know that I like to keep the vibes up. And that's why I'm a fan of federally legal cannabis from Mood.com. It's a brand that uses small organic farms to source its pesticide-free legal weed. You can get 20% off of your first order at Mood.com by using code JFK. My favorite product of theirs is the functional THC gummies. Usually I go with Epic Euphoria, but I also like Magic Mind and the Pure Relief CBD gummies. These legal weed gummies take about 20 minutes to kick in, and you can control the dosage yourself. Unlike the federal government, Mood.com has never sold drugs to fund illegal wars or clandestine missions. Thanks, Mood.com. So try out some of the excellent legal cannabis products from Mood.com and get a 20% discount off of your first order using code JFK. This episode of Solving JFK is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations. One of the reasons why many people believe that the mafia was involved in the assassination of John F. Kennedy is because the mob had motive to get rid of him. Given the performance of the Kennedy brothers on the McClellan Committee, Chief Counsel Robert Kennedy in particular, most of the bosses in La Cosa Nostra did not expect the Kennedys to suddenly become more lenient towards organized crime. Of course, Sam Giancana's agreement with Joe Kennedy Sr. likely had the effect of making the mafia hate the Kennedys even more, because on top of being overzealous law enforcers, they also broke the deal that their father had made. In this episode, we examine the posture of the Kennedy administration towards the mafia once John and Bobby had their hands on the levers of government power. Then we'll look at what the HSCA had to say about the likelihood of mob involvement before directing our attention to the key mafia leaders who are most likely to be involved in the assassination, starting with Jimmy Hoffa, Meyer Lansky, and Sam Giancana.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. When Robert Kennedy became Attorney General, he significantly increased the attorneys in the Organized Crime and Racketeering section of the Department of Justice. He also provided a list of 80 mafia figures to be investigated, each of whom was assigned an individual FBI agent. The FBI and the DOJ had more tools to pursue the mafia at their disposal because of recently passed legislation, supported by the Attorney General, that made interstate transportation in aid of racketeering a federal crime. Between 1960, the year before Kennedy took office, and 1963, there was a 250% increase in the number of attorneys dedicated to organized crime, a 500% increase in the number of defendants indicted, and a 400% increase in defendants convicted. This addition of resources made it clear that the mafia was more of a problem in some places than previously understood. Like Chicago, for example, where sources described, quote, the almost complete influence and control of politicians, police, and even courts by the underworld. By 1963, the FBI was aware of the names of positions and the hierarchies within the mafia, as well as the identities of the bosses operating out of major American cities. We know that the FBI had electronic surveillance on many mafia associates. Can any of these recordings shed light on how these people felt about President Kennedy before the assassination? On February 9, 1962, Willie Weisberg complained to Philadelphia boss Angelo Bruno about the Kennedys in a recorded conversation. He said that someone should kill Kennedy and that he would do it himself. But it wasn't clear whether he was talking about RFK or JFK. On May 2, 1962, two New York mobsters, Sal Profaci and Michelino Clemente, were talking. Clemente said, quote, Bob Kennedy won't stop until he puts us all in jail all over the country. Until the commission meets and puts its foot down, things will be at a standstill. In October of 1963, Chicago boss Sam Giancana and three of his associates were recorded talking about whether Bobby Kennedy played golf like John did. They then joked about putting a bomb in RFK's golf bag. On Halloween of 1963, Buffalo boss Stefano Magadino was heard telling his son that President Kennedy should, quote, drop dead. They should kill the whole family, the mother and the father too. These and other recorded phone calls and meetings from key mafia leaders anecdotally demonstrate that organized crime was intensely opposed to the Kennedy administration, which is exactly what we would expect given the aggressive posture of the Attorney General towards the mafia. Of course, the mob didn't let President Kennedy off the hook for his brother's anti-mafia crusade. This raises the question of whether La Cosa Nostra, at an organizational level, had some involvement in killing President Kennedy. The House Select Committee on Assassinations found that the commission, which is the governing body of mob bosses, and its members all had motive for wanting both Kennedys gone. But most of the commission members had their hands full with various other issues, as documented in the HSCA Organized Crime Report. Also, there are no recorded conversations about the commission being involved in a JFK hit, or even hinting at it, despite the growing use of wiretaps by the FBI. So it does not appear that the commission ordered President Kennedy to be killed. Still, not all individual mafia bosses could be ruled out, according to the HSCA, because the FBI did not have quality intelligence on some bosses. Unlike Sam Giancana and the bosses in New York, the FBI did not have any wiretaps on Carlos Marcello or Santo Trafficante. At the end of the day, the HSCA found Marcello, Trafficante, and even Jimmy Hoffa had, quote, motive, means, and opportunity to plan and execute a conspiracy to assassinate President Kennedy. The HSCA concluded that it was unlikely that they were involved in such a conspiracy. Nevertheless, the possibility that one or more of them was involved could not be precluded. Since we know that the assassination was not directed by the commission, let's take a look at a few individual mafiosos who may have had some level of involvement in JFK's death. We'll start with Jimmy Hoffa. Unlike other mafia higher-ups, Hoffa did not come up through the ranks of La Cosa Nostra. He was a union man from the start, rising to the position of vice president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters by 1952. The Teamsters represented a diverse array of industries from trucking to law enforcement to prison guards. Hoffa would go on to serve as the union's president from 1957 until 1971. During that time, he made the Teamsters Union the largest union by membership in the United States, with 2.3 million members at its peak. Hoffa's relationship with organized crime began as a result of his attempts to recruit truckers to join the Teamsters Union. Beginning in the Detroit area, which in the 1930s and 40s, during Hoffa's rise, was a powerhouse of American manufacturing, Hoffa made accommodations with the mob. He then courted mafia leadership so that he could get control of the Teamsters Union. In doing so, he turned the Central States Pension Fund into a mob slush fund and effectively made it a mafia subsidiary. Hoffa's relationship with organized crime grew closer after he was subpoenaed to appear before the McClellan Committee in the Senate. On March 14th of 1957, Hoffa was arrested for trying to bribe an aide to the committee. He was eventually acquitted of that charge, but the arrest, combined with the televised clashes with committee counsel Robert Kennedy, would put a target on Hoffa's back when RFK became Attorney General just a few years later. In fact, when he became Attorney General, RFK assembled a team just to focus on Hoffa called the Get Hoffa Squad. As one can imagine, being subpoenaed to speak before the Senate and then being pursued relentlessly by Robert Kennedy, Jimmy Hoffa had absolute disdain towards the Kennedy brothers. According to informant Edward Parton, who came forward only to avoid prison time himself, he heard Hoffa threaten to kill RFK in the late summer of 1962 by throwing a bomb into his car or home. Hoffa also mentioned to Parton, quote, "The possible use of a lone gunman equipped with a rifle with a telescopic sight, an assassin without any identifiable connection to the Teamster organization, or Hoffa himself." Hoffa also said that the assassination attempt on RFK should be in the South and when RFK was riding in a convertible. Harold Gibbons, Hoffa's top aide, also overheard him discuss killing the Attorney General. Hoffa was convicted of jury tampering and fraud in 1964 and began serving his term in prison in 1967. After 5 years of a 13-year sentence, Hoffa was released from prison after President Richard Nixon commuted the remainder of his sentence for time served. This commutation from Nixon stoked claims about Nixon having received bribes from the mafia in the past. Jimmy Hoffa disappeared on July 30th, 1975. Foul play was assumed, but his body has never been found. It's easy to speculate that the reason Hoffa was killed was to stop him from talking to the church committee, which was investigating intelligence agencies at the time. But there's no evidence that Hoffa had been subpoenaed. And it's also true that Jimmy Hoffa had many enemies, including rivals within organized crime. The holidays sneak up fast, but it's not too early to get your shopping done and actually have fun with it. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. The products from Uncommon Goods are high quality, they're unique, a lot of times they're handmade, and they're made in the United States. Many are crafted by independent artists and small businesses. And because they're made in small batches, the best finds can sell out fast. I can't tell you how many times I've gone to Uncommon Goods when I didn't know what to get that person who seemed to already have everything. Another great thing about Uncommon Goods is that they give back a dollar to a nonprofit partner of your choice every time you buy something. So far, they've donated over $3 million to nonprofits. So shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/JFK. That's uncommongoods.com/JFK for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary. I don't know about you, but when I need to get into that Curtis LeMay, sitting there watching the autopsy vibe, I look for a cigar that I can rely on. And that's why I love Thompson Cigar. They've been around since 1915, so they know a thing or two about cigars. Whether it's a quick 5-pack for the weekend or joining one of their value clubs, Thompson makes it easy to save while enjoying top-notch cigars. It's like having your own personal humidor with deals that you can't pass up. Visit www.thompsoncigar.com/JFK or use code JFK at checkout for 20% off of your order of $75 or more. Discover why Thompson has been America's humidor since 1915 and join the thousands of satisfied customers who trust Thompson for quality, value, and exceptional service. Meyer Lansky came in as an outsider, but quickly rose to the top of the American mafia. Lansky is known as the mob's accountant, which he was, but he was much more than that. Lansky and his associate, Charles Lucky Luciano, helped to grow and organize the mob by creating the National Syndicate. While Lansky was a member of the Jewish mafia, he introduced money laundering through offshore banking to the Italian mob in 1932. During Prohibition, Lansky began working with his childhood friend, Ben Bugsy Siegel, and the two of them formed one of the most violent gangs in New York. By 1936, Lansky had established gambling operations in Florida and in Cuba. His advanced math skills allowed him to understand the precise odds of specific games, which gave the house an edge. Aside from the house taking its cut, Lansky made sure that the games were never rigged. He also began to bribe local law enforcement to make sure that the operations were secure from other criminals and from government prosecution. When Nazism was on the rise in the late 1930s, Lansky gathered teams of strong Jewish men to break up Nazi meetings through fistfights. Some of the Nazis were thrown out of building windows. Lansky also helped to fight German Nazis by working with the Office of Naval Intelligence to watch out for Nazi infiltrators at loading docks, which Lansky controlled. In exchange for helping the feds, Lansky secured the release from prison of his longtime friend, Bugsy Siegel. Sometime in the late 1940s, Lansky met with Cuban dictator Fulgencio Batista at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York, where it was agreed that Lansky and the mafia would control Cuban casinos and racetracks in exchange for paying Batista a portion of the income. Batista also agreed to match any hotel investment over $1 million, dollar for dollar, which led Lansky and the mafia to develop even more casinos and nightclubs in Cuba. The Cuban hotel and casino business was extremely profitable while it lasted. Then, in 1959, when Fidel Castro seized power through the Cuban Revolution, many of Lansky's hotels were looted and destroyed. All casinos were then closed. The properties were then seized by the Cuban government, and gambling was made illegal on the island. Meyer Lansky's business wasn't just in Cuba. He also had a considerable stake in Las Vegas operations. According to the HSCA Organized Crime Report, Ed Levinson and Ed Torres were responsible for skimming $100,000 a month from the profits of legal gambling casinos to send to Meyer Lansky in Miami. The name Ed Levinson may sound familiar because Levinson helped Bobby Baker finance both his vending business and the construction of the Carousel Motel in Ocean City, Maryland. In 1970, Lansky went to Israel to escape federal tax evasion charges. At that time, under the law of return, any Jewish person could legally become an Israeli citizen, and Israeli law did not permit the extradition of Israeli citizens. Lansky, who had provided donations in the past to then-Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir, was surprised when he was denied citizenship and sent back to America in exchange for weapons from the Nixon administration. On January 15, 1983, Meyer Lansky died of lung cancer at 80 years old in Miami Beach, Florida. Let's move on to Sam Giancana, a quintessential mafia boss. We've already talked about Giancana in a few important contexts, namely his relationship with Joseph Kennedy Sr. and the work he did for the Kennedys in Chicago during the 1960 election. We also covered how Giancana got involved through his underling, Johnny Rosselli, in the CIA plots to kill Castro, as orchestrated by CIA cutout Robert Mayhew. Salvatore Giancana, also known as Mooney or Momo, started from the bottom as a getaway driver in a juvenile street gang in 1920s Chicago. He then graduated to working as a hitman for Al Capone. Giancana was the prime suspect in three murders that never went to trial and reportedly killed many more people. After serving a three-year stint in prison for burglary and then a four-year sentence for bootlegging, when Giancana was back on the Chicago streets, he successfully took over the numbers game on the South Side from local African-American gangsters Eddie Jones and Theodore Rowe, the latter of whom Giancana's crew killed. Momo's takeover of Southside gambling brought in millions to the Chicago outfit and was one of the main reasons he became the boss in 1957. In addition to being the top boss in Chicago, Giancana was well known for his relationships and deals with other mafia dons, especially Carlos Marcello and Santo Trafficante Jr. In 1954, Giancana bragged to his half-brother Chuck, quote, "In Tampa, I got Santo Jr. taking over. I talked to Lansky and the rest of the commission. He'll be the boss now. I got Marcello working with just me and Costello. Chicago's the only city Marcello's gonna let into Texas unless he talks to me first." Giancana stayed in the good graces of Marcello and Trafficante by giving them part of the cash that was skimmed from the Sands, Flamingo, Thunderbird, and Desert Inn casinos in Las Vegas. Giancana also shared several notable secrets that he learned about American intelligence agencies with his half-brother Chuck. For example, New York mob boss Frank Costello, who would often meet with J. Edgar Hoover, had tried to bribe Hoover, but he wouldn't accept it. Instead, Costello gave Hoover tips on fixed horse races, and Hoover then used that information to make money at the tracks. Giancana also told Chuck that the CIA had been taking 10% of the money made from narcotics flowing through Havana into the United States. According to his half-brother, Sam Giancana knew Guy Bannister well from Bannister's time as special agent in charge of the Chicago FBI office. Giancana also told his brother, quote, "We got Bannister set up with Marcello down in New Orleans when he took over the police department down there." Later, after Bannister left the police, Giancana said that Bannister, quote, "had an agency down in New Orleans now and is working on the Cuban exile thing with the CIA. Mayhew and Bannister work for the CIA all the time." If what Giancana said about Bannister is true, that's a really big deal because Bannister's job with the New Orleans police was to investigate corruption and ties to organized crime within the New Orleans police force. In episode 79, we talked about the relationships between Judith Campbell, Frank Sinatra, JFK, and Sam Giancana. The Judith Campbell-JFK affair was important because the end of it marked the end of the relationship between President Kennedy and anyone who was openly affiliated with the mafia. Judith Campbell first met John F. Kennedy in February of 1960 when her boyfriend, Frank Sinatra, introduced her. From there, Campbell had an affair with JFK for about 2 years that included multiple meetings across the U.S. There are records of over 70 phone calls between Campbell and the White House in 1961 and 1962. There's also a check written from Kennedy to Campbell for $2,000. Aside from JFK stealing Frank Sinatra's girlfriend, the Judith Campbell angle is even more interesting because during the last 6 months of her affair with the president, Campbell was simultaneously sleeping with Sam Giancana. According to Chuck Giancana, Sam said that he was the one who introduced Campbell to JFK, and he made that introduction with the hopes that they would have a relationship that Giancana could somehow manipulate. And that seems to be exactly what happened. Once Giancana found out that Campbell was actually having an affair with the president, it was only then that he began to pursue her romantically. President Kennedy had no idea about Campbell's relationship with Giancana other than that they were friends. On March 22, 1962, director J. Edgar Hoover had a private lunch with President Kennedy at the White House. We don't know for sure what was said, but we know that Hoover was briefed on Campbell's relationship with the mafia right before the meeting. And it's likely that Hoover shared with President Kennedy that Judith Campbell was also romantically linked to Sam Giancana. The last phone call between JFK and Campbell was just a few hours after the Hoover lunch. The split with Campbell was followed by President Kennedy distancing himself from his former friend and Sam Giancana's friend, Frank Sinatra. When the president was traveling in California, Sinatra offered him the use of his home, where Sinatra had a helicopter pad installed and an extra wing of the house built just so it could accommodate the president. Kennedy told his brother-in-law, Peter Lawford, who happened to be a member of the Rat Pack with Sinatra, quote, "I can't stay there with Sinatra while Bobby's handling the Giancana investigation." President Kennedy giving Frank Sinatra the cold shoulder and pushing Judith Campbell out of the picture made it clear to the mafia, and to Giancana especially, that the Kennedy administration would not be letting up its prosecution of organized crime anytime soon. On June 19, 1975, Sam Giancana was cooking sausage and peppers in his kitchen when he was shot dead 7 times with a silenced .22 caliber pistol. There were no signs of forced entry, so it's been speculated that Giancana must have known the killer. The next day, June 20th, 1975, Senator John Tower told the New York Times that the church committee had located Giancana shortly before he was murdered, but that they had not had a chance to interview him yet. Senator Church confirmed that the committee planned on calling Giancana as a witness. Despite strong speculation that either the mafia or the CIA is the culprit, the murder of Sam Giancana remains unsolved. Next time on Solving JFK, we continue looking at mafia leaders and focus our attention on Johnny Rosselli, Santo Trafficante, and Carlos Marcello. If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit solvingjfkpodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information.